for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A grand jury indicted a 24-year-old Afghan immigrant on charges of plotting a bomb attack against the U.S. The Senate Finance Committee is moving through hundreds of amendments to their version of the health care overhaul plan. In the House, Speaker Pelosi plans to revive discussion about a possible public health insurance option. And signs from the U.S. economy continue to be mixed. Joining me to talk about the week's top news, Lynn Sweet, Washington Bureau Chief at the Chicago Sun-Times, and the columnist at PoliticsDaily.com. Chris Saliza is the author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com, and Juan Williams is NPR news analyst as well as a news analyst for Fox News. And we'll take your calls throughout the hour, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. If you like, you can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning, everybody. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Diane.
Juan Williams, what about this Afghan immigrant? What do we know about him?
Well, you know, we don't know that much. I mean, we know his name. We know he's 24 years old. His name is Najibullah Zazi. And we know that he was arrested, and he was working in Denver. And the source of concern that the FBI has about him is that he was collecting hydrogen peroxide and other chemicals that could be used to make bombs. In fact, they have been used to make bombs previously.
He was going to beauty salons
to get this stuff. Exactly. But there's also then been the arrest of his father in Queens, New York, and his father is Mohammed Zazi, and then an imam from Queens whose name is Ahmad Afzali. And the thing about Zazi is the 24-year-old from Denver, is that he was caught on a wiretap apparently talking to Al-Qaeda operatives in Pakistan. And that's what makes this case quite different than anything you may have heard of, the things that were taking place in Lackawanna or Miami or Chicago, which seem to be people coming out of American jails and American-generated anger or something. But this was peculiar in that there's this Al-Qaeda connection, and it's caused the FBI now to think that there might be something more extensive at work. So this case is not over. These three arrests are not the end of the story. They're still looking to see if there are other bombs out there. And the targets, Diane, were troubling. The targets were airports, sports arenas. And so you see lots of alerts around now at major sporting events.
NPR's Juan Williams, Chris Saliza, they have released his father on bail this morning.
You know, Diane, it's a kind of a fascinating thing. I think the ears were pricked up at the FBI when he traveled from Denver to New York City. He was detained briefly and then let go. Zazi, we're talking about the younger.
Right, he 24. Was,
at that point, he denied repeatedly that he had any connection to Al-Qaeda. Well, 48 hours, 72 hours later, he's now said, yes, in fact, he was in Pakistan in the summer of 2008, spent 4 months training with operatives with ties to Al-Qaeda. So I think Juan makes the exact right point here, which is this is something that can be traced not too obscurely back to Al-Qaeda, that this is someone who had ties, who trained there. This is not sort of a rogue person operating, you know, just generally. This is something that could well be coordinated and could well wind up being much bigger and much more meaningful in terms of our battle against terrorism than many of the things that we've seen since September 11th.
Chris Saliza of WashingtonPost.com. Lynn Sweet, was the investigation at all compromised by any kind of conflict between the New York City police and the FBI?
Well, I know that there have been suggestions of that, but I don't know ultimately if it would have yielded more suspects at this time. The the investigation is remarkably detailed, as people now realize they leave tracks everywhere, from the man's laptop to his conversations to the purchases of hydrogen peroxide from the Colorado beauty salons, even the detail that he tried to cook up the substance to try and condense it. There's a lot known, and clearly what this episode shows is that not only the threat of international terrorism is there with links to al-Qaeda, but we've also had arrests of homegrown domestic terrorists this week that shows, I think, just the two ways that Americans could be under attack, both from people on the inside, what you just mentioned, somebody coming from inside an American prison. That very example was arrested after trying to blow up a courthouse in Springfield, Illinois.
Lynn Sweet, the Chicago Sun-Times. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Juan Williams, in what way is the Justice Department changing the Bush administration's policy on keeping state secrets?
Not much, is the short answer. They're not being very clear about how they're going to go about doing this. The big ticket here, Diane, is the Patriot Act. And they're saying basically at this point very little, indicating that they don't favor congressional oversight, apparently. And if you ask them about, you know, things like what's going on.
When you ask them, who do you mean?
Well, what you had was people testifying on the Hill this week. And when the congresspeople asked them questions about existing protections under a Patriot Act, pretty much what they said is, we're not ready to talk. I mean, when they asked about things like sneak and peek, and Senator Feingold said, you've done this hundreds of times, and it's overwhelming. I think it was only three times it's been for use in terror cases. It's overwhelmingly used in drug cases. The response was, well, that's no surprise. They're just not worried about it. So it seems like they're really continuing much of the... Now, this is the story, I guess, to your listener. These folks in the Obama administration are not doing anything much differently than what was done under the Bush administration.
Lynn.
Well, what's interesting here is that Obama already has some questions from people on the left, from his supporters over health care, which I presume we'll get into later. This is another example of the Obama that people thought they knew and perhaps don't. I don't find this very surprising because as a senator, he was willing to make very pragmatic choices. This is a big one. And I think it will puzzle people who really haven't studied his history as a senator, who don't quite understand that he is willing to adjust his circumstances. And I think, Juan, everything you said is so right. And I think he will catch heat from the left wing of the Democratic Party.
But what about Attorney General Eric Holder? Doesn't he have to approve this kind of approach?
He does, Diane, but again, I think that's much more about sort of what the president's directive is broadly on how to handle these issues. You know, I do think, to Lynn's point, I think many people who voted for Barack Obama, particularly many on the ideological left, believe that on day one of the Obama administration, they would roll back many of the controversial, many of the disliked, frankly, policies put in place by the Bush administration, the Patriot Act obviously being one. I'll give you another good example, and I'll promote my own newspaper. We had a great story this morning about Guantanamo Bay. This was something that the Obama administration addressed very early on, said that they would shut it within a year. That year is now about 4 months away. Greg Craig, who was in charge of that shutdown, has been moved out of being in charge of that shutdown. There is now talk that it will not, in fact, be shut down in that time frame. So it does go to show you that sometimes when you do things that it is not as cut and dried as it may appear from the outside, that closing Guantanamo Bay seemed like the right thing. Liberals wanted it done. The president put it in place and did it, and now they're running into a lot of struggles, both politically and from a policy perspective with it.
Now, going back to the Zazi investigation, a 19-year-old Jordanian is due in court this morning on charges he placed what he thought was a bomb in a parking garage beneath a Dallas skyscraper. So how does this whole Secrets Act relate to the investigation we've had going on in New York, Colorado, Dallas.
This is complicated, so let me just try. But what you see is, remember, that was a wiretap that got Zazi talking to people in Pakistan, the Al-Qaeda people. Remember also that the New York City police have their own special investigations unit on terror cases.
Because they're very, very concerned about New York.
They were tracking this imam in Queens. The imam apparently was in touch with Zazi. So at some point, the New York City detectives said to the imam, "We're getting questions about your guy being Zazi." That upset the FBI and forced them to preemptorily then go after and get Zazi because they thought that at that point he might flee or take some action. That's why they don't know the extent, how many other people were in this game and how many other people. They have, by the way, obtained the handwritten notes. Zazi had handwritten notes on bomb making. And apparently, I say this because this is based on reporting. It's not something I personally know. And if they have, and on the basis that they worry that he was also giving these instructions to other people, other operatives. So this Jordanian that you're telling me about right now, Diane, it may be one of these people. We may be over the next several weeks watching as various little pockets are revealed.
And that's the question. Will they be revealed?
Well, Diane, we hope so. I'm rooting for our team.
Yeah, precisely. Juan Williams of NPR and Chris Eliza of WashingtonPost.com and Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll focus on the U.S. economy. We'll take your calls, questions, 800-433-8850. And welcome back to our domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Chris Eliza, where do we stand on the healthcare debate right now?
If this show is 4 hours long, I could probably give you the full update, Diane, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
Look, the main point of action this past week, and it will continue the main point of action, is the Senate Finance Committee.
Of course.
Never have these people been as exposed or as cool or as desired as they are right now. You have Max Baucus, the chairman, a Democrat from Montana, moving a bill. It is in it's what's called a markup. Essentially, amendments are added to it. Eventually, the full Senate Finance Committee will vote on it. We expect it to pass. It's a question of what, and then it will of how many votes, and then it will go for a full vote in the Senate. What you have seen in the early going of this markup is you have seen Republicans try to do a few things. The biggest of which is to move on Medicare. Medicare is being cut back. The money to insure the millions of Americans who are currently uninsured has to come from somewhere. Remember, the president has been absolutely hardline that this will not add to the debt. It has to come from somewhere. One of the places it would come from is Medicare recipients.
How?
It will come from one way to save money, and this is why it's controversial, is to cut the reimbursement rates for Medicare providers. And that is controversial because you're talking about people's paychecks. Now, if you're on the receiving end of Medicare, you know this when you try to find a doctor to go to, and they don't want to take any more Medicare patients. I just, for a quick example, if you're looking for a gynecologist, some of the specialties, people can't afford it if they load up their practices with Medicare patients. So if you either expand the program and at the same low rate or lower the rates, yes, you save money, but you have a controversy at your plate.
And just really quickly, Diane, one important political consideration, Medicare, obviously something used by lots of older Americans. Older Americans are very, very reliable voters, more reliable than any other age group. And when you come up into a midterm election where turnout is significantly less traditionally than a general than in a presidential year, angering senior voters is not a recipe for success.
Yeah. And over on the House side, Juan, you've got Speaker Pelosi pushing once again for the inclusion of a public plan. On the Senate side, you've got Rockefeller and Schumer doing the same thing. Is the public option out, or is it hanging by a thread?
I think it's out, but you know, the thing of it is that there is, if you look at the public polls, this is really interesting to me. If you look at the polls, most Americans like the public option. There's a little bit of news this week when Bill O'Reilly said he likes the public option,
well,
the conservative talk show host on Fox.
Well, go ahead. One thing that I think was interesting, Pelosi said it at a briefing yesterday that she suggested that she might have a standalone vote on the public option, and I think this will be a very interesting maneuver. Usually you don't go and take every element of a bill in a separate vote. My God, Congress would never end.
What would that mean?
Hold on. It could help. Maybe said it would probably lose, but it would let the people within her caucus. The problem Nancy Pelosi has is different than the Senate Democrats have. They're not going to lose a lot of traction over the hardcore public option people in their chamber. It is a problem for Speaker Pelosi that challenges her leadership. And if you have a standalone vote, that is, in a sense, show me. You want it? Fine, get the votes. And I think you call a vote like that when you know it can't pass. But that is a tactic that maybe we should be looking at her to call, because it would be a tough day for her. She would satisfy the left, but it would still be in a move that would probably fail.
Yeah, let me just throw in here something, pick up on something Chris was talking about, which is, I think we don't often talk about generational warfare in this country. But when you look at what's happening with the health care negotiations up on the Hill, it's hard not to think, well, gee, it looks like one particular group is being very well protected. For example, yesterday, Republicans tried to say there can be no cuts in Medicare Advantage, which combines your Medicare deal with private insurance. And so the Democrats blocked it, saying, wait a second, there's got to be some savings in here. Or you think about, wait a second, the drug companies, there has to be more savings coming from the drug companies. That becomes a big issue because people want to make sure that the drug companies don't pump up their prices because, as you know, seniors are concerned about the high cost of prescription drugs. This just goes on and on. And the question is, well, are we serious about this, or are we playing politics?
And that's the question. Are we going to get something this year?
I would be stunned, though I've been stunned many times in politics, so it wouldn't be a first. I would be stunned if we didn't get something, if we didn't see some kind of ceremony with the president signing something, simply because they have put so much into this, and getting nothing would, I think, remind them of exactly what they were trying to avoid at the start of this debate. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, 1993, and we all know what happened in 1994 with the Republican tidal wave. I do think, though, Diane, just quickly, Juan's point is the right one. The dichotomy between public polling that seems to suggest a public option is popular, not just among Democrats, but also among many independents. And yet I think you have politicians, and they are a reactive species by nature. We know this about them, who are very nervous. They saw those August town halls. They think that voting for something like this could anger the Republican base enough in those conservative-leaning independents to defeat them. So they are taking the, as often happens in politics, the path of least resistance here, despite, you know, I won't say overwhelming evidence, but certainly evidence that there is support for the public option in the country.
There are two measures, though, that I think will survive. I agree with Chris that something will happen. And the two items that I think will survive are you cannot be canceled if you cannot be denied insurance if you have a pre-existing condition. And insurance companies will be forced to give the policy coverage that they promised and not look for a loophole to cancel your coverage when you get sick.
You know what surprises me is that during the campaign, then candidate Obama campaigned on this national health insurance plan. Or public option plan for your shaking.
I'm shaking
your head.
My head because he was careful on this. He never said he was forcing. He long ago abandoned his belief in single payer. He never said that he wanted health insurance for all, which then rival Hillary Clinton did. All he said is that people would voluntarily buy insurance if you made it cheap enough. He also, during the campaign, said he wasn't for an individual mandate. Now he is for that. So I think the campaign, you can't go by what President Obama is going to do now necessarily by what candidate Obama did in the campaign.
How did this health care debate turn so much against the president?
I think he lost, and this is ironic because he ran such an extraordinary campaign, but I think that they ran a very bad campaign to sell this to the American people. I think there was the sense in which they felt that this is obvious. Everybody agrees. It's tied to the economy and to the economic problems the country is facing.
Right.
Look at how many companies complain about the high cost of medical benefits for their employees. Look at how many people individually, especially when struck with some catastrophic medical incident, personally are bankrupted. Everybody would look at the number of uninsured in the country and especially the high number of underinsured and say something must be done. Some of the things Lynn was talking about, portability, people not being given insurance if they had previously existed. Everybody say, there's something wrong with our insurance. We spend more than any other Western industrialized country. Let's do something. So they thought, you know what, deal done, let's move. But no, in fact, what they allowed to have happen was bickering up on Capitol Hill, which is unattractive in any environment, and secondly, Republicans to caricature it. And Republicans have been acting as obstructionists, basically, on health care. They have not been cooperative partners. So they have talked about pulling the plug on grandma. They have talked about socialized medicine. They have talked about rationing to these very seniors that
death panels.
Oh, my gosh. I don't think grandma's in trouble.
You know, I always think that the current president is either haunted or certainly influenced by the past president. And I return back to the Clinton example on healthcare, the last Democratic president to really try to do something major on healthcare. What was the long-standing criticism, the takeaway from the Clinton effort? Behind closed doors, Capitol Hill was not involved. They did the plan and just gave it to us. So what does the Obama administration do? They swing the pendulum the other way and say he doesn't have a specific plan. He wants to hear from you. And to Juan's point, you got 535 members up there, each of whom think they probably should be president, and they certainly are capable of overhauling the healthcare system on their own. There are all these ideas. The pendulum swings too far. By the time he steps in this address to a joint session of Congress earlier this month, it's probably too late because the die has been cast. The cake is baked in a lot of ways. The bills are moving through Congress. So for the president to come now and say, this is what I specifically want to see, he's a little bit late to that game. So, you know, it's fascinating because they did the exact opposite of what the Clinton administration did, and it still hasn't worked.
Final question on the health care. Do you believe, Lynn Sweet, we will get something?
Yes, I do.
All right, and Juan Williams.
Well, you heard what Lynn said. Now, Lynn,
yes. You
said something, but that was a small point of insurance reform, right?
Well, something.
That's
something.
Okay. But Lynn, it's not anything near to really reforming the medical system in this country. I think it's a real.
Well,
it's going to be a defeat ultimately. I don't. But he'll say I signed something, but it will be a defeat for this man who made this the centerpiece of his domestic agenda.
I don't think, I'm disagreeing. I think he had a lot going on in the campaign, and I don't think health care reform necessarily was the centerpiece in a campaign that was highly aspirational. And he could have a second bite at the apple. You could take something and move on. You can't go, what's the point of not doing something when you can. People go back on these issues all the time. They're in the midst of many issues that they readdress.
No,
so
I agree.
I think one of the things in politics that we all know, sometimes you win when you just put up the sign that we victory sign and you move on.
All right, and we'll move on now to the economy in general. We seem to get news that's really rather mixed. Housing sales, 4-month streak of improvements in existing home sales, number of newly laid off workers seems to be falling, and yet, unemployment still in there, Chris.
You know, Diane, to your point that the Federal Reserve met earlier this week for 2 days, and I wrote down two quotes that came out of that meeting, which are not diametrically opposed, but to your point of mixed news. One was economic activity has picked up, which surely brought, you know, cheers and smiles from Democrats. The other was the economy is likely to remain weak for some time. So you have it's getting better, but it's not good yet, and it's probably not going to be good for some time. I think the other thing to think about, and you know, I tend to see things through a political lens. So the other thing to think about is how much does the economy need to improve, whether that's unemployment, whether it's GDP, and at what time does it need to be to improve for Democrats not to feel the wrath of voters in 2010? Because remember, if the economy starts improving in September of 2010, roughly a year from now, it's probably too late. In all honesty, in terms of how politics works, for Democrats to run on the economic stimulus bill and its successes.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Lynn Sweet.
Well, one thing that will be interesting to see what happens, the first-time homebuyers credit, the $8,000 credit for mortgages, is scheduled to expire. I think it's a question of whether or not Congress decides to extend it, because a big part of the housing market, about 30%, I've read, is of first-time homebuyers, and this credit is something that's very helpful. The Obama administration, when you ask at what point do people say it's still bad, I think if housing prices and housing sales, if they don't have an uptick, I think none of us think it'll go back to what it was a few years ago, if the prices merely stabilize and people are frozen out of the market, I don't think that's good enough at this point, even though there's been some achievement. So I would watch for whether or not the mortgage market and the mortgage, what they call modification program, that has not been going as fast as the Obama administration had hoped. Let's see if they could get that going. A mortgage modification is where if you're in trouble in your mortgage, there aren't a lot of federal programs now that have been encouraging you to go in and will make some adjustments so you don't have to lose your house.
Want.
Well, the one thing I'd say is don't overreact, because remember that even though it fell, it was at an all-time high in July, I guess. It fell during August, and it's the second highest in the last 23 months were housing sales in August. So, you know, you have to factor that in, as you know, these things are a little bit up and down, but it's not radically. It's just that everybody's so sensitive and so nervous,
exactly,
given the economic climate.
All right. I want to ask you all about Acorn. We have heard more and more allegations about Acorn. Senator Charles Grassley released documents showing that leaders of Acorn transferred several $1 million in charitable and government money meant for the poor to arms of the group that have political and sometimes profit-making missions. Lynn.
It's a tough time for the organization. They got in trouble because they mixed up their charitable and government arm with politics. Most organizations are just a lot more careful, and they became a target even before this latest video expose. They were a target during the presidential campaign. They're seen as an arm of the Democratic Party. And why many nonprofit organizations pull this off on a daily basis, they just were different because they had large amounts of federal money coming in, and they just didn't keep their bookkeeping straight. They had a new CEO who came in who was supposed to clean it up, but this still happened on her watch.
But it happened on her watch. The video was taken questionably illegally? What would you say?
You know, Diane, these videos that have come out that have really spurred the story along, it's funny. It shows kind of where we are in journalism, is that it doesn't almost matter. I mean, I think it matters as a philosophical debate, but it almost doesn't matter sort of how and why they were obtained, just that they were obtained. I feel like the ball has now moved down the road. Lynn's point is right. For a very long time, conservatives have believed that – have been looking for a way to get at Acorn, believing that their voter registration tactics were you know, borderline illegal, if not outright illegal, that that they were essentially an arm – a organizing arm of the Democratic Party. This has given them fodder. I think I get asked a lot, how is this going to affect the president? How is this going to affect Democrats in Congress? You know, it still seems to me this is an issue that animates the bases of both parties. It is very much an issue that animates conservatives, and liberals, I think, feel as though they have a say in this because they feel as though Acorn is being unnecessarily put upon. I'm not convinced it gets into a political realm. Republicans are trying to turn it into that, but I'm not convinced it gets into President Obama or Nancy Pelosi or Democrats in Congress.
Chris Elizabeth, WashingtonPost.com. He's the author of The Fix. Short break, and when we come back, time for your calls. I look forward to hearing from you.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Kiplinger Foundation, supporting public understanding of business and the economy. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. At the UN, President Obama calls for a new era of engagement with the world. Debate heats up over U.S. strategy for Afghanistan, and environmental groups lower expectations for progress on global climate change. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's go first to Arlington, Virginia. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Surely.
This is Ann Cook of Red Zone Politics. I want to say hi to my friend Juan Williams. Hi,
hi.
Juan.
How are you?
Quick two things. The Acorn situation is completely indefensible, either any way you look at it. And, you know, I'm about to read The Family by Jeff Charlotte. He went into, you know, the right-wing fundamentalist, you know, inner circle to do his own sleuthing from the other side of things. So I actually think these things are very useful, and it keeps the press honest. But really what I want to talk about briefly is just the branding and the language, the rhetoric that the Democrats are using for health care and have used, primarily the word public for public option. See, to me, the word public is a code word that the right wing uses. If you go and look at FreedomWorks, look at Dick Armey's discussions, for instance, on public education, the word public is really a four-letter word that's used by the right wing to denigrate people who sort of the have-nots of society. And it's used to paint the Democrats as sort of being the underwriters of people who can't take care of themselves, and that often ends up equating to minorities. So I actually was on the phone this week with a number of congressional offices, including Max Baucus's, suggesting that they switch out the word public and public option and say consumer-friendly or taxpayer-friendly or citizen-based. And Max Baucus's rep on the phone said, oh, yeah, it's a matter of rebranding. I said, exactly.
All right. Thanks for calling, Juan.
Well, I mean, I've heard this line of argument that it's being made out to be for the poor, for minorities, et cetera. The absurdity of this line of argument is it goes to the point of some people saying it's about reparations for blacks is what this health care program is about. But I don't think that's the heart and soul of it. Rebranding might help, I guess, with the word public, but what's the heart and soul of it is I think people who are comfortable with it haven't done a good job of selling it.
Juan, I want to go back to the question on ACORN because mm-hmm. an awful lot of people have called me, have called on this program suggesting how come Republicans took out after ACORN so quickly when Blackwater was accused of so much malicious behavior and not one went after.
And continue to get government money and to function as an arm of the U.S. military and to this moment. Not only Blackwater, but let's stop and think about it. Think about Wall Street. And all of the kinds of things, the Bernie Madoff, all that just goes right past, you know, the SEC and all the rest, right? So you have that. There's so many, seems to me, scandals of major magnitude. What did ACORN get? $50-something million over more than 10 years. So about, you know, $5 million. That's a margin of error question in the U.S. economy. But not when it comes to ACORN, because somehow ACORN has been politicized to the point that they are now being targeted not only by Republicans, but they have Democrats fleeing from them. And so they're the bad boy of the moment. But it is, if you look at it from the larger picture, it is ridiculous that this much effort and media attention goes to ACORN, which is basically designed to help poor people get housing, as opposed to the Blackwaters of the world.
To Juan's point, there's a lot of political grandstanding on this issue. Tim Pawlenty, the governor of Minnesota, who is going to run, very likely to run for president, the Republican nomination in 2012, announced that he was directing the state government to cut off any funding to go to ACORN until there was a further investigation. Well, it turns out the ACORN rep is quoted in the Minneapolis Public Radio saying, well, we weren't getting any state money anyway. So, you know, I mean, the truth of the matter is this is a touchstone for conservatives. People like Tim Pawlenty who want to rally conservatives, who want to raise their name ID among conservatives, are using this. It's like anything else that gets out into the public sphere. Politicians will use it for their own political best interest. It's not necessarily getting at the heart of the issue.
All right. To Parkland, Florida. Good morning, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm a fan of all of yours, so I've enjoyed the discussion so far. I just want to make a comment on the Zazi case because there's some import there that, while I think it might have been Chris who touched on it very briefly, it was very briefly touched on, and I think it's one of the greatest concerns for this country right now, is that there are more and more homegrown terrorists in this country. And I think one of the problems that we're all faced, and I think the media tends to perpetuate it, is we use the names of terrorist organizations as euphemisms. It's very easy to say the Taliban or al-Shabaab or the Taliban, and we assume it's over there, but the most what ties them all together is radical Islam and the ideology of Sharia, which is now pervasive in this country. And until we start addressing how pervasive it is in this country, we are going to continue to have more and more homegrown terrorists, and we need to address that as much as we address foreign terrorists.
It's interesting that I think there are a great many people who believe that there are that the country is filled with terrorists waiting to act, waiting to blow up railroad stations, subways, airports. Here's an email from Scott, who says, I am an Obama supporter and I support the Patriot Act. Surveillance lives and thwarts terrorist plots. The Patriot Act sunsets every few years. Congress can continue it or revise it when they see fit. So the Patriot Act ongoing concern about terrorists in this country, whether they are homegrown or otherwise.
You know,
Chris.
It's a very basic balancing act, which is how much of your personal privacy are you willing to sacrifice to be safe, or at least have the feeling of safety? And is sacrificing some level of your personal privacy actually resulting in you being safer? I do think the Bush administration did damage to that argument in terms of feeling as though they overstepped the lines. I think so that's why you see the Obama administration, as Juan pointed out, maybe not as forcefully as many people would like, but trying to say that they were going to raise the bar in terms of the ability to keep secrets from the American public. But it is that basic yin and yang of personal privacy versus public safety, and how do you balance that, and what's the right balance? And, you know, we're now 8 years removed from September 11th. We continue to struggle with that.
Well, I think the struggle's a little more defined. At least this week, you had the convergence of these two stories of these arrests of the homegrown and international terrorists converging with the story about the Obama administration reluctance to really radically change the Bush blueprint. So I would think right now that these arrests will probably trump trump everything and trump any move by the Obama administration or people within it to water down anything that could be leaving the president open to be seen as soft on terrorism.
Juan?
Well, I think the caller is off when he says pervasive, that this Muslim extremism, Sharia law is now pervasive, or some element of it is pervasive in American life. I've never seen that in the Muslim community in this country. But I will say that there are pockets, and his point is that there are pockets of people who are angry for one reason or another, and especially in the jails, and you have a lot of Muslims in the jails, and so a lot of extremist and radical behavior and talk and rhetoric circles around, and that's what we, you know, sometimes come across in these pockets. The difference here is the Al-Qaeda connection. I would say that the big thing to pick up on the caller's point is the Obama administration is not going to risk another attack on the United States. That is just so politically forget it. I mean, people are uptight about Democrats and national security anyway. That's seen as a weak point. So you can imagine they're going hardline on Patriot Act and every other step to maintain that high level of protection.
All right, to Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Frank. Frank, are you there? Okay, let's go to O'Fallon, Missouri. Jerry, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. About 5 years ago, I remember William Ford, when he was the CEO of Ford, saying that we could build a Volvo in Sweden cheaper than a Taurus in the United States. And I think that's the essence of the public health or public option debate. Here in the St. Louis area, our largest company and one of the largest employers, Anheuser-Busch, was taken over last year by a foreign company. And I think it's just a matter of time before they realize that it's so much more expensive to make things here, brew beer, make cars, because of the fact that when you go to another country that has a single-payer plan, that's not on the backs of the companies. And I just wonder why we don't see more CEOs of other companies. It seems there's a minority of people that benefit from the way things are currently, and they're blocking the way of progress for really everyone.
Well, one of the interesting point that you make, Mr. Caller, because the Obama administration had hoped to get the buy-in of America's CEOs by passing laws to make health insurance less expensive. So it would be positioned as helping business, not necessarily spreading government-run health care. And, you know, when you talk about branding, that was an important point. And since single-payer just is not going to happen now. I don't know, with all due respect, though, if your comparison is apt. President Obama has said many times, if you could start a system from scratch, he would favor single payer, but no one is proposing that. So you kind of have to go with improving the employer-based system that we have. The public option, of course, would let another kind of insurance option be open to people, and they wouldn't just have to go to their employer. And as many people have raised the point, the question for people is, well, would employers eventually ditch their plans if they knew people had another place to go?
But, you know, you've heard some Republicans say it's time to throw this whole thing out, since there is something like 564 amendments that they've been dealing with on the Senate bill. You know, are they saying start from scratch, or what are they saying, Chris?
They are not saying start from scratch, especially if start from scratch would include single payer. That is sort of an absolute, we will not, do not pass go, do not collect $200 for Republicans. What they are saying is what the minority party always says, which about every bill, major piece of legislation that moves through Congress. It's being moved too quickly. There are too many amendments. It's too big a bill. People aren't reading the bill. These are the very common criticisms that do go with it. This is a complex thing. There is a reason that healthcare has not been broadly overhauled in this country. It's not just complex from a policy perspective, because if it was complex from a policy perspective, I think there's hope that it could be changed. But from a political perspective, there are so many people cross-purpose, so many people worried, so many people nervous. That's what, when you have the policy and the political elements, it makes it very tough to do something
big. 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Matthew in Cincinnati, Ohio, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for keeping the dialogue honest with your panel on this program.
Thank you.
I want to bring it back to the health insurance, health care reform that we're talking about. And I agree with the woman, the first call from Arlington, Virginia, about the way we're framing this. I want to say this to the panel. I want to say this to anybody else out there that has a podium and is speaking to it. There is no health care reform. That's not the crux of the issue. It's health insurance reform that we're talking about. And I think when you talk about health care reform, it conjures up a lot of feelings that we don't need to bring up. I'm not against for-profit medicine. I think profit is a good, you know, I think it's a good motive in some places, and I think it's just fine that hospitals and doctors make money. I think the problem is that there doesn't seem to be a good reason why, and no one can explain to me why there should be someone in between making a profit off of handing money from myself and the pool of employers or whoever it is to my doctors. I'm just having a hard time understanding that right now.
Well, I'll try to help, but the first thing to say is that if you care about Medicare and Medicaid in this country, those systems are on track to go bankrupt not that long into the future. So it's not as if there's, you know, an ample amount of money to pay for these very critical systems that take care of a large percentage of our seniors. Okay, and then the second thing to say is that the high cost of medicine in this country has already prompted a Republican president, George W. Bush, to put in place a prescription drug benefit plan for seniors. We haven't paid for it. It's not funded. Talk about things that don't have funding mechanisms attached. But again, the idea was you can go out of the country and get drugs at a cheaper price. And the drug companies continue to charge, some would say, extortionist rates for drugs
but
in this country.
But, you know, I think there are a lot of people like Matthew who wonder about why it is the insurance companies have to get between the patient and the doctor. Why are insurance companies really necessary?
Why are they necessary?
Why are they necessary? Why can there not simply be a relationship between the patient and the doctor funded overall by the federal government that eliminates that middle insurance plan?
Well, if I could try to jump in, if you look at Medicare, which is the government-run plan for seniors, which a lot of people who complain about socialism don't quite get, even under that system, you can't just go in and ask for every procedure in the world, because even Medicare. So even under your proposal, I say with all respect, doesn't necessarily mean that people could always get everything they want when they want it. If we even look at Medicare as the example, and you're saying, why shouldn't we be able to?
No, what I'm saying is that we've got to have a more realistic approach to our health care system. And he is saying insurance companies, health insurance is the problem, not necessarily the whole health care system.
But I'm a little puzzled. But because I think you need insurance, and given the risk attached, the number of people who die and all that, and the government wouldn't be assuming all of that risk. So you have insurance companies that assume it. The question is, do the insurance companies act in the interest of those patients, or are they acting simply to make money? And so far, they're doing pretty well.
Juan Williams, Chris Cizilla, and Lynn Sweet, I thank you all so much. Great conversation this morning. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Diane Rehm.